Hi, I'm Professor Allen.
And I'm Emily, and you're listening to the Short Box Showcase.
Episode 10, Feedback and a Guest.
The purpose of Short Box Showcase is to talk about comic-related topics that fall outside of our individual podcasts.
Since we did our last Feedback episode, Emily and I have been crushed by iTunes reviews, smashed by emails, and just stomped on by Facebook and Twitter conversations. It feels like we've been facing down the King of Monsters. So we asked Godzilla's best friend on the internet to join us. Ladies and gentlemen, but mostly gentlemen, Luke Giaconetti.
Oh, hey, how you doing, guys?
Thank you.
Great to have you here. Now, Emily, what's the real reason that Luke is here?
Well, for people who listened to our first Feedback episode, might have noticed that about a third or so of our feedback came specifically from Luke Giaconetti. Well, since then, approximately half of our feedback has been from Luke Giaconetti. So we figured, let's just cut out the middleman. Let's just have him on the podcast.
You know, I've often been accused of taking over shows with my emails. This is the first time I'm actually taking over a show with my emails.
Congratulations.
Well, you know, I'm a professor of business and finance, and we are all about efficiency. We just thought this was the most efficient way. I thought I was a pretty faithful podcast listener and a pretty good emailer to shows. But it's not even close to what Giaconetti does on a regular basis.
We consider ourselves humble. I told Sean Engel this a while back. It's much easier to write an email to a better show than to produce your own show. So the irregularity with which Earth Destruction Directive is released, writing emails is a much faster, easier to accomplish task.
I mean, no pressure, Luke, but 4 episodes of Ultraman down, 35 to go.
Yeah, that's not even counting the 51 episodes of Ultra 7 or the, you know, episodes of Ultraman back.
I have to tell you this. I was doing some Christmas shopping recently through the Two True Freaks Amazon link, of course. Since Emily is here, I won't tell you exactly what I did order, but my finger did hover above the Ultra 7 DVD collection.
Yeah,
the problem is it was like 10 times as expensive as the Ultraman. Ultraman's like $6.
Yeah, and that's because Mill Creek released it. Mill Creek does discount or budget releases on all of their products. Ultra 7 is through Shout Factory, and Shout Factory does much, much more robust presentation. They also released the DVD set of Ultra Q, which was the first Ultra series, which is probably best described as a Japanese mix of The Twilight Zone and The X-Files.
That sounds intriguing, but you got to remember, my other show was about reviewing cheap comic books.
Yeah.
Just gives you an idea that the $44 price, I couldn't...
This episode started as a feedback episode.
Do you have some feedback to start us off with, Emily?
Our first email is actually feedback for the Quarterbin podcast.
Hey, I like that show. That's one of my favorites.
It's a great show. Episode 5, ROM Space Knight number 46. Hello, Professor Allen. Forgive me for only just writing to you, but I have been behind on several podcasts and missed out on yours for a long while. But I finally caught up and have just finished episode 5. It seems vague to say that I enjoyed the show, but that's the case. I loved your dramatic readings of Mantlo's caption boxes, as well as your historical perspective on both the issue and the Chile international relations in play in 1983, that obviously had some kind of influence on the tone of this comic book. And like you, I have to wonder if Russians would find the portrayal of their countrymen in this issue entertaining, funny, or offensive. I can be a little touchy about how people in my state are depicted in media, so I would relate to them about this. Your shows tend to be short to the point and more powerful for those things. It gives your comments tremendous focus. In any event, it would be fair to say that I really dig your show and now regret more than ever how behind I got on my podcast listening. Excellent show and keep up the good work. His Excellency, Magnus.
That seems like a nice, mellow way to start the show. I mean, I think that's reasonable. We expect all the comments to be of similar. I really like that issue of ROM. And just spoilers, there are a couple of more Mantlo episodes coming up. I found some Micronauts in the Quarterbin recently, so those will be coming soon.
I do like we got a nice mellow email from a very intense guy in Trentus.
Yes, it was, he and I, our shows started at pretty much the same time. The shows tended to be about the same length. I thought, oh, we've got a lot in common. And he's slightly more intense than I am.
I was going to say, and then you friended him on Facebook and learned.
I've actually done a recording with him. It'll come out at some point, and who knows when. He's about 3 months ahead. That's something crazy.
Yeah.
But I like that issue of ROM. You know, 30 years ago, looking back on U.S.-Soviet relations, that was when you commented on as well, Luke.
My very imaginatively titled email just says ROM. I'll give a reading of this one. It's fairly straightforward. Professor, loved episode 5 of the Quarterbin podcast.
All right, well, that's enough, Luke. Thanks.
Good night. Because who doesn't love ROM Space Knight? And as my friend Adam says, communists, that's who. Regarding ROM, I wanted to share with you a quick story about a missed opportunity with the character a few years back. You may recall the Marvel event Secret Invasion, in which a massive Skrull invasion of Earth was revealed. The hero of the story turned out to be Norman Osborn. And it led to the non-event Dark Reign. But let's face it, if the Marvel Universe is invaded by shape-changing aliens, ROM is the guy to call. Who has more experience in blasting shape-changing aliens than ROM? No one. I mean, that says it on his business card, I'm pretty sure. My friend Adam and I concocted this scenario. As the Skrull Queen reveals her master plan, up rolls ROM, who blasts her with his neutralizer. In the wake of saving the world, ROM is hailed as a hero and uses that newfound fame to enslave the Earth. Now he sits upon a steel throne, surrounded by his harem of superheroines with chained collars around their necks as we puny humans strip our planet bare in tribute to ROM. Now that would have been a story worth reading. Alas, it was not to be, and ROM lives on in back issue bins only. Thanks for the fun show.
Sigh. Yeah, later on, you have some other interesting pitches and ideas for stories that we'll get to as well. But I thought that ROM story was interesting. Looking back, you know, 30 years into a Cold War type of scenario, my take on it was that I couldn't quite tell if Mantlo was mocking the Russians, was trying to make them appear reasonable. I couldn't put myself 30 years back.
Yeah, it's an interesting vintage because I'm a very big Iron Man fan. I just finished my run, not this past year, but the year before at Heroes Con, so I've got a full run of Iron Man. And as a character, Iron Man often dealt with the Cold War, especially as we got into the early 80s, like that ROM issue. So you see a lot of that in the Iron Man book, and it's interesting to look back, and you can kind of get a gist of maybe where the creators were on the political spectrum, what they thought about the Soviet Union at the time. A lot of times, especially in Iron Man, you see the Soviet characters are portrayed usually fairly well as relatively good guys that are in, you know, a lousy system. The Dmitry Bukharin Crimson Dynamo, who is the one who would go on to become Airstrike and is probably the most commonly seen Crimson Dynamo. There's been like a dozen of them. You know, he was always portrayed as a generally a guy who was honorable and decent, but he just played for the other team. And so him and Stark had kind of a grudging respect. And he was always portrayed, like I said, as a fairly straight shooter. Then you get somebody like the Titanium Man, who was a diehard communist, you know, really believed in the party. And so he was fanatical. But a lot of times under like Dave Michelinie and Bob Layton, he was portrayed as this fanatical communist, but he wasn't a cartoon. He was just very loyal to the party, much the same way that Tony was loyal to capitalism and democracy. So you're right. It's especially given the very jingoistic nature of the way communism was portrayed all through the Silver Age, it's very interesting to see how that evolves as we get into the 80s and we get into Reagan's presidency especially. That really is kind of the thing where that's the turning point in how I think communist characters are portrayed. And then, of course, once the wall falls and the Soviet Union comes down, those two events, all bets are off. How your Russian character...
Exactly. Exactly.
Actually, a great story, one that Len Kaminsky wrote in the early 90s after the fall of the Soviet Union with the Titanium Man bemoaning the fall of it. And he has a line that he cries for Mother Russia because, what is it, all of her sons aspire to be gangsters and her daughters aspire to be whores.
Mm. Mm.
It's like, yeah, right. To a guy who was, you know, who was a staunch party man, that would be a very devastating blow, you know?
Trentus was also nice enough to give us some iTunes feedback. Got some iTunes feedback also from Ben Avery. He's a co-host of the Strangers and Aliens podcast, and he's also hosting a Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. TV podcast, which I think is called Welcome to Level 7.
This one is related to the Quarterbin episode on hacks. Ben Avery writes us, "You got me. I have over the last decade or so held hex issues in my hand or hovered over the bid button on eBay for a hex. This review sealed it. This sounds like a little bit of cheesy comic joy. As soon as I get home, eBay."
You know, I told Ben, and I tell, and you know, 25 cents is a really low bar. There was some fun in hex number one. We do have hex number 18 also, the last issue. I'm not sure I'm going to fill in the 16 in between from what I hear, even from diehards like Scott Gardner.
Yeah. It's definitely worth 25 cents, $4.
Mm. I'm just saying. I'm just you can't hold me accountable.
Hex is one of those books that I always say, at least they were trying something different.
Yeah.
I mean, I gave him credit for an audacious concept. Western hero pulled out of time. Okay. Jonah Hex meets Adam Strange?
Mad Max?
Yeah, something, yeah, in a Mad Max setting. You know, you can see again the elevator pitch for that one.
I do also, I'll always remember that they do a very sly reference to Hex in the Justice League cartoon.
Yes.
And the Once and Future Thing part one, when our heroes are transported back to the Old West and meet Jonah and Batlash and a couple other of the DC Western heroes. Jonah looks at our heroes cockeyed and says, "I reckon y'all are time travelers." Also has a great line when Wonder Woman does her bullets and bracelets routine, says, "Those are the biggest, slowest bullets I've ever seen."
Yeah, okay, I could see.
Not even a challenge at that point. And I have been picking up All-Star Western, the new 52 Hex. And recently they've been sort of doing a little bit of an homage-ish to the Hex miniseries that Jonah is now in the modern day. He met up with Booster Gold, and now he's trying to figure out how the 21st century works. And it's an interesting concept. I'm not entirely down with it, but again, it's sort of like Hex. It's doing something interesting, so I'm giving it a lot of credit for that.
Yeah, but I like the first few arcs of All-Star Western when he was in old-timey Gotham.
It was really good. Really good. So I'm hoping he gets back there at some point, but I'm enjoying the day trip to the future.
You can seem to let their genre books just be genre books. They always seem now. Yeah. And I'm a fairly even-keeled fan. I generally like what DC's doing. I've generally liked the new 52. I think there's been a few missteps, but you know, no publisher is perfect. But one of those missteps to me is that I really applauded them for doing genre books. You know, we got two war books when the new 52 began in Men of War and Blackhawks. We mm-hmm. got All-Star Western. We got Sword of Sorcery, which was Amethyst, and then the backup was Beowulf and then Stalker. So just their old school fantasy properties. And we also got G.I. Combat, which did The Unknown Soldier and then The War That Time Forgot and Haunted Tank. It's like, I applauded the use of the genre characters, but they had a hard time letting them just be genre books.
Right.
Men of War, which was the update to Sergeant Rock, took place squarely in the modern day DCU, and Cersei was involved in the first story arc. I'm like, why don't you just tell a war story in a Sergeant Rock comic? Same goes with Sword of Sorcery. Amethyst existed in the DCU, but generally her adventures took place in Gem World, and she wasn't involved in the DCU except for events like Crisis on Infinite Earths. And then in the first issue, there's John Constantine. And it's like, I don't need John Constantine. Just give me Amethyst and Gem World, and let me get my fantasy story.
Right.
So that's been kind of a pet peeve of mine, but I like genre books, so I understand that I'm not really the target audience for that.
The two books that we picked up with the new 52 were All-Star Western and Demon Knights.
Ugh. The fact that Demon Knights is canceled still makes me crazy sad.
But those, you know, those genre books, I like. I Vampire was okay. It was actually pretty good. And I liked Frankenstein Agent of S.H.I.E.L.D.
That was also really good.
And I certainly think I Vampire could have worked almost as a miniseries. You know, I miss the days of the miniseries. in comics where we say we're going to tell a 6-issue story and that's it.
Yep.
Or 4 issues or 12 issues, but that's it. And maybe it's disconnected from the greater DCU, maybe it's not, but we're just going to tell this story and that's it. And it doesn't have to be the soap opera of ongoing stories. We can move into adaptations talk.
So I've heard a lot of about that episode on other shows, actually. Was it? It was Stephen Lacey and Andrew Lavelle. Fantastic. Mm-hmm. We're specifically mentioning that one because it's such a great topic. I know when you guys said, we're going to talk about adaptations, I'm like, now that's a lot of ripe fruit to pick on that. I know I wrote in, you guys, I did want to ask a question about what I call an overlay or a pastiche adaption. That is, you take an established property and you put a new genre on top of it. Some of the examples of this that I've really liked are the TV series Phantom 2040, which took the Lee Falk Phantom and put him into the year 2040 in a science fiction setting. Similarly, there was an animated series called Sherlock Holmes in the 22nd Century, which, despite its ridiculous title, is actually quite good. Because it does use Doyle as the majority of the stories. It just updates the stories for a sci-fi setting. And then the Disney film, and I'm a bit of a Disney fan, the Disney film Treasure Planet, which was a version of Treasure Island.
I adore Treasure Planet. I wouldn't say it's one of the best films of all time, but it is in my top 10 just favorite films. I can pop that or Thor in any time of the day or night. And actually, my favorite show that's on TV right now is one of those sort of pastiche adaptations. I think it counts as Sleepy Hollow.
Yeah,
which
totally.
I keep telling people, no, it's awesome, and they're like, well, but isn't it the story of Ichabod Crane? But he's in the modern day, and he's like a cop or something. And I was like, well, yes, and he fights ghosts, but by that point, I've just lost them. I'm like, no, it's really good, really good.
Yeah, like we said, I mean, some of those, you know, you can hear the elevator pitch. It's Sherlock Holmes in the 22nd century. Okay, great. What are we going to call it? Okay, you could have taken maybe a little more thought to come up with a different name. But
you know what, though? I'm not one of these guys that likes to conscript British sayings and use them as an American, like a lot of folks my age seem to do. But there is one I really like, and that says, does what it says on the tin.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. You call your show Sherlock Holmes in the 22nd century. By God, you put it on, and there it is.
Now, no one's going to sue you for false advertising.
Now, in that episode, I said one of the items that I would like to see adapted into comic book form would be the great sci-fi movie, Galaxy Quest.
Yes.
And unfortunately, I got called out. By Dave Walker of Flash Legacies podcast, who said, oh, there already is one.
Mm-hmm.
It did, I don't know, 4 issues or 6 issues or something. So theoretically, I should go back to the drawing board and come up with something else. But that was such a good one.
I know.
I can't come up with...
You know what, I'll still give it to you for the other various Galaxy Quest universe.
So
comics.
You could do it a couple different ways. You could do the further adventures of the actors, the cast, which I think is what the comic was. So I'm still going to stick with my original idea of comic book versions of the show, the adaptations of the show.
Oh, so, yeah. The very end of that movie gives you your pitch for your comic.
There you go.
New Adventures of the Galaxy Quest with the new cast and Guy Fleegman. Head of security, you know?
Yes.
Now, more than once in our correspondence, Luke, you have expressed an interesting fascination with Scrooge McDuck.
Yes.
Explain, please.
You know, Scrooge McDuck, for those who may not know, is the richest duck in the world. And the way that he became the richest duck in the world is actually this incredibly epic and involved story. There are two very well-known and beloved duck artist. The first is Carl Barks, who was the original good duck artist, as he was called, who created Uncle Scrooge and was the main author and artist for a majority of his adventures. And then the more modern one is Don Rosa, who I had the pleasure of meeting at Heroes Con a few years back and talking to. And Rosa did a series of stories that were collected as The Life and Times of Scrooge McDuck. And they're in two very nice hardcover collections, covers this very big 12-part story. And it starts out with Scrooge as a young duck in Scotland. And it follows his life through all of the stories that Carl Barks told, that other artists have told, of how Scrooge earned his fortune. And, you know, Scrooge earned his fortune from his number one dime up until his big vault of money that he swims in. And these stories, they're not little, I mean, they're all ages stories, but they're not pandering. They're not just gag strips. They're action adventure stories. You can read Uncle Scrooge comics and see echoes of the 1930s and 40s action adventure serials, even things up to like Raiders of the Lost Ark and Indiana Jones and a Temple of Doom. There's a school of thought that you can look at Raiders of the Lost Ark, like the giant ball trap from the beginning is straight out of an Uncle Scrooge comic. So Uncle Scrooge was an action-adventure comic, just happened to star anthropomorphic ducks. Reading Uncle Scrooge is much like you guys talk about Tintin. I always put Uncle Scrooge kind of in that same boat, and it's one of the great all-ages comics of all time, in that you can be a little kid, you can be an adult, you can be an older person, and read them and just love them because they're so much fun and there's so much heart and character. But the thing about Scrooge that I've always liked is that a lot of people think about Uncle Scrooge, we think about him like from DuckTales. You know,
mm-hmm. Right.
That's how I know him.
He's a rich old eccentric duck, and he has adventures with his nephews. But one of the great things about the life and times of Scrooge McDuck is that besides that, we see him working every possible way he can to make it in this world. He starts out with nothing as an immigrant except his number one dime. And we see him as a diamond miner in South Africa. We see him in the Klondike searching for gold. We see him, you know, chasing after oil. And we see all of his, the friends he makes, the friends he loses, meets and loses the girl that he falls in love with. And by the time at the end when he's earned his fortune, right at the time when we first run into him chronologically, first time that he was introduced in a Barks story, he's a bitter old man. And he has absolutely nothing because he spent his whole life chasing down money. And it's only through connecting with his nephew Donald and then Huey, Dewey, and Louie that Scrooge becomes this guy that we're more familiar with now. And so it's just a great story. I often said before Disney bought Marvel that if Disney wanted their own comic book movie, doing a lushly animated Uncle Scrooge movie would be fantastic. It's, like I said, it's much in the same vein of a strip like Tintin or Asterix, where you look at it, it looks like kid stuff, but it's just fantastic all-ages fun.
I actually think that's an important distinction. I think some people hear all ages and they think kids.
Right.
And I think Pixar and some of the great animated movies we've seen in the last decade or two, some of the great animated series, I think, prove that that isn't always the case.
Oh, yeah. Pixar is the perfect example of that. Because I've got three young children, so I watch a good deal of Pixar. And I'm perfectly okay with that because I like all their movies. But there's so much in those movies that is perfectly acceptable for the kids, because they're not mature enough necessarily to grasp some of the concepts that they're dealing with. You know, we watched Monsters Incorporated. The concept of that, about the father figure, you know, moving heaven and earth to take care of his surrogate daughter. You know, when you're a little kid, you're 4 years old, you don't get that. You see monsters being silly and you laugh. That was always the strength of Disney back in the golden age, you know, when Walt was still around and the nine old men, was that their properties were all ages and that truly could be enjoyed by all. I still to this day think one of the best movies of all time is Mary Poppins. Talk about an all-ages movie right there. You know, anybody can watch Mary Poppins and have a grin on their face the whole time.
Seems in terms of comic books these days, it either has to be gritty and dark to sell. And I think part of the problem with comic books is, as we've gotten older, to some extent, comics are still trying to sell to us.
Yes.
I'm outside this range, but trying to sell to 25 to 40-year-old men instead of trying to sell to the next generation. There was a thought, maybe up through the 80s, that comic book readership would turn over every 5 or 6 years. So you could literally tell the same stories. Pretty darn close versions of stories over and over again. Reset continuity. Continuity didn't matter as much as it does now.
And you guys got into this a little bit on your episode talking about the different ages, the different eras of comics. Is that, you get into the 80s, and now you're seeing the pros that were the guys that grew up in the Silver Age. And when continuity became much more important versus what it had been in the 40s and 50s. The guys that grew up as guys reading the Marvel Revolution as, either kids or teenagers or even college students, they were the ones that now were becoming pros. And Emily, you covered this on the Bronze Age, is that the from the 60s into the 70s into the 80s, they all kind of grow on each other. And so things that were started in the 60s became more prevalent in the 70s, then even more so in the 80s, even into the 90s. I recently had this discussion with Sean Engel. We were talking about specifically the Green Lantern villain Fatality, and how I said, oh, I love characters like Fatality because they're so encapsulate what the 90s was doing, which was doing what we were doing in the 80s, but doing more of it. So villains got meaner and nastier in the 80s. We're going to make them even meaner and nastier in the 90s. The same general idea.
And give them even more pouches.
Extreme!
Extreme up.
And you're absolutely right, Professor. It's hard to find good all-ages stuff from the big two. There are a few. One that I have really championed is the Manipul and Buccellato Flash from DC. They're, besides being downright gorgeous, because you got two artists working on the book, and they're writing and doing the art. So that is a... It's a gorgeous book, and what they like to say is you have to read the art. That there will be in the art that are part of the story that they're not going to necessarily put in a caption. And I just saw, I think last week on Newsarama, that they are going to be heading over to Detective Comics next year.
Interesting.
And so I was like, wow, all ages Batman stories, are those even legal anymore?
Are they possible? It's blowing my mind.
Emily's talked about The Flash before, and in terms of legacy characters, it's nice to have a family-friendly Flash comic, if you will, because theoretically, The Flash is a family book, as Emily's talked about before, but the elder statesman Jay and Barry, you know, when you get that entire happy marriages, which DC might not believe in anymore.
I do understand where guys like DiDio and Lee are coming from with marriage. DiDio made a good point, and this, I don't think this got publicized very much. He said, you know, the universe is just starting in terms of the new 52 universe. It's only been around for 2 years, 2 years and a quarter so far. Why are we rushing into marriages? You know, and I was thinking about it, and he's got a pretty good point. You know, it was the fourth year of Fantastic Four before Reed and Sue got married. It was a number of years after Man of Steel before Lois and Clark got married. So it's I can understand where he's coming from with that. And in one sense, they're also doing, I think, new things with some of the relationships. You know, over in Flash, Barry is not dating Iris Allen. Iris Allen is a major character in the series, and they're good friends, and they work together. But he's dating a fellow police scientist named Patty Spivot that was introduced right before the reboot. And again, then Superman and Wonder Woman are an item. And that's never really been done before. So it's like, well, you know, again, at least they're doing something new. And of course, this being the age of the internet, you go online and everyone says, oh, all DC's doing is keeping everybody exactly the same. And then they change something.
Oh, no.
Like
no.
It.
Yeah.
Fanboys don't want to have it both ways. They want to have it an infinite number of ways.
This is why the multiverse exists. I'm just saying.
As I like to say, you know, like, and again, I hate to agree with Brian Michael Bendis, but I had to. And when he killed Hawkeye in Avengers Disassembled, he made a great point. He said, this doesn't change the 40 years of Avengers comics with Hawkeye you have already in your house.
That's true.
I'm not going to break into your house and wreck up the place and steal your Hawkeye comics.
I mean, there's a lot of truth in that. I like what, I guess it was Shag and Rob, you know, came up with in a Fire and Water podcast. I think it was Shag, may have blogged it or Facebooked it, about just finding your joy.
Yes.
You know, finding the era, the type, in my case, the price point for comics that you like. And, you know, don't feel pressure to read new. Don't feel pressure to read even what everyone else reads, even the quote-unquote new comics that I read in trades, usually from the library. So at most, I'm 4 to 6 to 8 months behind.
Yes.
And that's not the end of the world.
Yeah, no, it's
not. To be a little bit behind.
I just finished reading the 90s Morbius series from Marvel. And I'm a big fan of Morbius because I like monster heroes like that. And it's like, I'm reading a book, it's 20 years old. What difference does it make? It's new to me.
And in a few years, the new comics that you're reading now are going to be old. So, you know, why? Whatever is new now or news now is going to be irrelevant in a few months or a few years. And the fact that it's new isn't all that important to me.
there's a great saying that my wife and I each use in relation to something being trendy. Remember, if something is right now, that means it's only 15 minutes away from being 15 minutes ago.
Mm. Yeah, I gave up on some of my comic book news podcasts for that reason. In some of those, I might fall 6 episodes behind, and what they're talking about is hot news has either been retconned or changed, or I'm thinking, hey, why am I listening to this now that it's obsolete, and why would I listen to it new now, knowing in 6 weeks it's going to be obsolete?
I don't know if you guys are Simpsons fans, but one of my favorite throwaway gags for an episode of The Simpsons is Marge and Homer in bed, and Homer is reading Hot Lotto Picks Weekly magazine. That's what I feel like sometimes.
On that adaptations concept, you had talked, Luke, some of your suggestions, one of which was the book series by Mack Bolan. And you and I went back and forth about that. Tell us just a little bit about what that series is. And it seems so obvious in retrospect, so custom-made for comic books.
The Mack Bolan series, which is started out as just the just one series called The Executioner, starring the character Mack Bolan, was created by Don Pendleton. Oh, I'm going to get this wrong. I think it was either the late 60s or very early 70s. And the Mack Bolan character, he was a Vietnam veteran who had come back to the United States, and then his family was killed by the mafia. And I know what you're saying, Luke, that's the Punisher. And I'm telling you, no, it was the Executioner first. And the Executioner and Punisher are very similar in a lot of respects. And so his series of books, and there have been, I think, somewhere over 400 from the initial series of Mack Bolan books published. This is going to explain a lot. They're published by Gold Eagle, which is a subsidiary of Harlequin. So much like Harlequin pumps out romance novels, their Gold Eagle imprint pumps out the Executioner novels, and then their sister series, Stony Man, which is kind of like the intelligence group that he works with, and Able Team, which is a commando team, and things like that. So he's essentially like a American version of James Bond. He goes into a situation, investigate it, and bad stuff's going down, and then he ends up, you know, using a lot of gunplay and violence to take out the bad guy. One I just finished reading was called Force Down, which involved Bolan fighting against basically a frontier army based out of Brazil that was made up of criminal enterprises all the way from South America into the Caribbean. And so he's got to go into Jamaica and then down into Brazil to take out this criminal network that is holding a series of U.S. Marines hostage. And so it's just very basic type of action adventure, men's adventure, as it used to be called, stories. That's absolutely perfect for a comic book. You know, there's no reason you can't have just a tough guy armed with a gun and having a support crew back at home being dropped into some place and just going to town on bad guys.
I mean, you've got, like you said, hundreds of storylines to pull from. You've got the same basic demographic as comic books. Mm-hmm. You know, young men. And lots of action. It seems like a no-brainer.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I work in Greenville, South Carolina, and we have a used bookstore here called Mr. K's. And in their action section, I mean, there are, at any given time, several hundred Mack Bolan books. You could just pick one up and use that. Just grab it. It's like, oh, this one takes place in the Antarctic. We can do a story in the Antarctic. Here we go. There's no reason that you can't do it. Now, there have been some Executioner comics. I think Dynamite did a miniseries a couple of years ago. So it's out there. The concept is there. I just, it just hasn't caught on as much as, say, James Bond or other action heroes of that vein, or The Punisher, for that matter. Like I said, I lived through the 90s, so I remember when The Punisher had 3 monthly titles.
Right. And obviously, from the quarter bin, I'm a fan of John Sable, which is sort of that little lighter version of James Bond, bodyguard / detective / whatever the plot calls for. All-around man of action. Retrospect, kind of amazed that got, 56 issues and then a couple of attempts at reboots with other creators.
Grell was able to get that partially because it was at Eclipse, and Eclipse would do offbeat titles like that. I know they did other books like that, and they did some more varied output than the big two at that point, just because, it was the 80s comics market. There was the LCS was going to save the industry, so...
Yeah.
I know one of the other ones I mentioned from movies and TV was Person of Interest. the CBS TV show. You'll talk about another property tailor-made for comic books. I mean, I've always said that I can't wait for Marvel to make a Heroes for Hire TV show because literally the plots walk in the front door and hire them every week. But with Person of Interest, it's very similar in that, you know, the computer gives them a number every episode and now you have your story. There's always that story engine, which is important in an ongoing comic to say, okay, well, why we finished this adventure, why are we having another one? That was always the strength, like I said, of the Luke Cage Hero for Hire comic, and that's the strength of something like Person of Interest. And again, you've got a well-established story engine, and you've got a lot of action built into that just because Mr. Reese, who is, he's a stone-cold bad dude, you know? So
what I like about what they're doing in the TV show, as sort of every season goes by, they're starting to do some longer arcs that are pulling the season together. Now, they still have the adventure of the week, you know, which would be your issue, but you could wrap around that, seeding future plots. There are plenty of subplot opportunities there. Again, that's another one that's could be custom made for comic book form.
I mean, even in just the first season, they had three major villains.
That's right.
You know, Elias, who was the criminal threat. They had Root, who was the hacker, the technological threat. And then they had the entire corrupt police force as well. And all I remember thinking at times, like, this is set up like a series of supervillains for the hero to fight. And each week, it's not every week that they show up, but their influence is felt, like you said, Professor, over the span of the season. Now, Emily, you mentioned the just-announced deal with Marvel and Netflix. I'd love to get your opinion. For those that may not have heard, Marvel announced they're going to be doing a series of 13-episode original dramas on Netflix starring Daredevil, Jessica Jones, Luke Cage, Iron Fist, and then wrapping up the four of them into a Defenders series. So I'd love to get your take on that. I'm super excited myself.
Oh, I'm crazy excited. I don't have a very long history with the characters of Power Man and Iron Fist, but since we've been watching Ultimate Spider-Man, the animated TV series, I've just fallen in love with the characters. Gone back and read a few of the older Heroes for Hire stories. I'm really enjoying them. So I am super excited. It's something that myself and my dad and tons of other people on the internet have been talking about, of wanting more street level heroes to finally get their chance in the limelight. And this is a really good way to get those, because there's no way that you're going to get an Iron Fist movie or something like that, because it's just not as big a property that they're not going to be willing to invest the time and the money in making a blockbuster, hoping that it'll make its money back. But if you've got it in a TV series and it's on Netflix, then there's a lower bar for success. They're more willing to try something out there. I'm super excited. I am ready for it.
The crazy thing about the movie business is that characters, that either Power Man or Iron Fist or them together, is that it's hard to position that as a blockbuster. There aren't enough opportunities for special effects to get the movie expensive enough, which seems to me to be the exact opposite problem.
Yeah.
You know, you should look at those characters and say, oh, we can do this movie for $40 million. It doesn't have to cost $150. But if you only spend $40 million, you can't position it as a blockbuster movie.
You can't get enough attention.
Yeah. It has to be a special effects-laden movie to sort of hit that criteria.
And you know, when you say that, Professor, all I can think of is I'm a big G.I. Joe fan. Mm. And two G.I. Joe movies take opposite approaches to what you were saying. The first G.I. Joe film was a big summer tentpole, big special effects movie, tons of CG all throughout the movie. Despite what people want to tell you, that movie actually was quite successful and made a good deal of money.
Yeah.
The second one, Retaliation, was made on a much smaller budget and featured much more in the way of stunt work and action than it did in the way of special effects, and cost quite a bit less. And Paramount and Hasbro released that in March instead of in the summer and made a very healthy profit doing that. So the idea is like, well, if Transformers is the big $200 million special effects-laden summer series, maybe G.I. Joe can be the one that is in the early spring that costs less but still makes a tidy profit. So that was where I had always thought to position the street-level Marvel heroes. The original Daredevil film came out the weekend right after Valentine's Day. I remember because my wife, who was just my girlfriend at the time, we went and saw it that weekend. We went out to dinner beforehand and all that. So I'm excited for it. I think the Netflix concept means that, you know, you don't have to impress the advertisers. If Netflix is happy with the show, they're going to let it be aired. You don't have to impress your network executives or your advertisers on a week-to-week basis, like a show like Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. has to do. So I think it allows you a little bit more creative freedom. And these four characters, I'm not super familiar with Jessica Jones outside of being a supporting character to Luke Cage, just because I never really read Alias.
Yeah, that's the one that seemed to come a little out of left field.
I know her from the old Marvel book, The Pulse, because The Pulse was a book about the underground newspaper, aptly titled The Pulse. And I said I know her from being Luke Cage's girlfriend and now wife and a mother of their child. Daredevil, we're all very familiar with Daredevil. J. David Weider has just started a new Daredevil podcast, which is, I told him, it was perfect timing. I said I was thinking about Daredevil a lot, and I want to learn more about Daredevil, and here you go making a podcast for me. Thank you so much.
He's good about that.
And I think Marvel's done a great job with picking these four properties as far as something that can appeal to a wide audience. I mean, the story of Daredevil, the guy who is a lawyer by day and a crime fighter by night, I think that's that's always been a strong concept. I think that's something that even non-comic readers can get behind because it's such a great dichotomy. The Iron Fist I'm more familiar with from the 80s, Danny is very naive, extremely well-meaning guy who was just completely unfamiliar with modern society. There's a scene in one of the very first issues after Power Man changes over to Power Man and Iron Fist where Danny Rand spends $200 on a 3-card Monty game outside their office just because he's going to buy it. And Luke's like, that's a scam. He's like, I know, but you know, I was curious. I have spent way too much of my life thinking about the character of Luke Cage. I always chalk it up to same name syndrome. That was
how possible.
Because his name was Luke.
One other thing, in one of your emails, Luke, you mentioned The Unknown Soldier.
Mm.
And you had a movie pitch for that.
You'll notice I'm an eclectic, and that's a blessing and a curse, because I like a lot of things, so I end up, my attention gets drawn a lot of ways. But The Unknown Soldier is one of the most genius war comic properties of all time. Basically, if you're not familiar with The Unknown Soldier, he was a soldier who in the very early days of World War II was the last survivor of a foxhole, basically, in the Philippines, and he was hideously scarred. His face was just completely destroyed. But his brother had always said to him that every man was important because the right man in the right place at the right time can change the tide of a war. And so now that he was given a discharge because of his injuries, but so he concocted this idea that he pitched to FDR, and I'm not going to do an FDR impression because Rob Kelly is the best. Let me be that man in the right place at the right time. So he trained to become a master of disguise and would interject himself into different situations to subtly change the outcome in the Allies' favor. My favorite ones, a very early one by, I want to say, Bob Kaniger and Joe Kubert, had the soldier was going to assassinate Hitler, and the only reason why his assassination failed was because of the bomb plot, the plot by the other Germans to assassinate Hitler like we saw in the book and film Valkyrie.
Right.
So if not for the bomb plot, the soldier would have been able to assassinate Hitler. But, you know, again, that lends itself well because he's a master of disguise, you don't have to have a guy whose face is wrapped in bandages as your star. So the one I always said was you get Lee Marvin to play the soldier. And by playing the soldier, I mean Lee Marvin plays this high-ranking SS official that the soldier takes the place of while they're going to a weapons test in Bavaria, and he has to go sabotage the weapon and then escape out of Germany into Allied territory. It's like, you tell me you can't see Lee Marvin in that movie, circa like 1968 or so.
So this pitch involves time travel, not of the characters, but of you.
Well, yes. Well, I mean, Lee that also doesn't really help, you know. When if you can, I mean, war movies are not as, you know, not as popular as they used to be. But I can see that working. The soldier had a contact in the French Resistance called Chat Noir, who was a U.S. soldier that defected because he was treated like a second class citizen because he was black. So he joined the Resistance. You could bring in Mademoiselle Marie, one of the most underrated DC Comics characters, I think, of all time. I think, you know, Mademoiselle Marie was a Resistance leader. It's like those stories write themselves, for crying out loud.
Nice thing about that is as long as you don't make the stakes so high, you know, yeah. If you make it there, he's trying to turn the tide in this one particular battle, you know, maybe save a village, something like that. And the drama is he going to accomplish that? Will he get caught? Can he escape? Then yeah. I think the period setting sounds like a winner to me. Well, that's a good place to take a break. So we're going to drop in a promo here, and we will be back in a second.
Hello, this is Steve.
This is Dave.
And this is Jim. Join the Waves of Tech crew as we explore technology in today's society.
We have information and discussions on blogging, computer tips, social media, entertainment, product reviews, education, and technology news.
Join us. It's all there at netcaststudio.com.
You've decided to go to a nearby restaurant. You ask the hostess to seat you in a booth. As you sit, you notice an animated conversation among the four seated behind you. They're talking about Star Wars and Doctor Who and something called the Laugh Olympics. These are the people you used to pants in high school, and yet you cannot help listening. Unable to tear your ears away, you realize you've just been sucked into the Dinner for Geeks. Dinner for Geeks, weekly at twotruefreaks.com.
And we're back. Our next email is from Charlie Niemeyer. And this one's directed to me. Awesome. Welcome to the Bronze Age, Emily. Since I enjoyed your first episode, and so far only episode, so much, I'm going to look past the fact that you're invading my podcasting territory without permission. Since I haven't read much from this era outside of the Superman books, I look forward to your coverage of this particular era, and wish you the best of luck with your show. As for Professor Allen, I am enjoying your show as well. It is a shame that sticking with the 25-cent or bust method prevents you from getting the full stories sometimes, but I am enjoying the variety of books, even after only four episodes. And as for your combo show, this is a good balance of your other shows, allowing for a broader look at comics. Another great show. Keep up the good work, Charlie.
Can't argue with that.
So the voice of Galactus.
Yes.
You know, he seems so nice on his podcast, but then you give him a meaty role.
Yeah. Well, you know, Galactus
will hand it all the way.
He is neither good nor evil. He simply is.
He just is. He's a force of nature.
The next one is directed to the professor. Hi, Prof. I was disappointed to hear that you were so unsatisfied with Bloodsport and Action Comics 702. I have fond memories of that time of the Superman titles, and have always preferred this version of Bloodsport to the original. Reasons for that are many, and I admit, probably a little bit selfish, so I won't begrudge you for not having the same fondness I did. Plus, it's been years since I read that particular issue at all, much less with a critical eye, so the comic might not hold up were I to read it today. However, I do want to address one point. I think you might be reading a bit too much into the religious overtone of the issue. Again, it has been a while since I read it, but the idioms cited by the characters don't sound too out of place or unusual, especially given the types of dialogue prevalent at the time. I feel Bloodsport's costume and chest insignia were intended to be an allusion to the Ku Klux Klan, many groups of whom use the modified cross iconography, as well as red and white color schemes. If I recall correctly, a previous appearance of this version of Bloodsport stated that he was a member of the Klan, the Aryan Brotherhood, or some similarly named DC Universe analog. You might be onto something concerning the cover, though. While hiding Bloodsport's chest symbol could be just a coincidence of the layout, it was also obscured in his first cover appearance, and difficult to make out in his third and final appearance. Given the sensitivity about racial issues, obscuring the logo on the cover, where context is much harder to discern, wouldn't be surprising. That's it for now. Keep up the good work. That was from Michael Bradley of The Thrilling Adventures of Superman.
Yeah, that was an interesting one, because I sort of knew when I was reading that you are preached at. The racial part of the story is not subtle in any way. So when I took sort of a second reading to it, I probably had consciously taken that particular type of reading into it. It is hard to ignore the big red cross on the guy's chest. And I think what really led me to read it in that particular way was that issue ends with Ron Troop you know, summarizing the moral of the story, and Clark saying, amen to that, brother, amen. Now, Clark could have said 100 different things. Exactly. That's right. I'm with you, Ron.
Word up, brother.
Word up, homeboy. Though, maybe not. But he could have said nothing. I just think when you end something with the word amen, it's not crazy to read a religious implications into that. Obviously, a story can work on many levels. But you had some comments about the Bloodsport issue as well, Luke.
Yes, I did. And again, my very creative email titled Superman and Bloodsport. I said, Professor, you mentioned that the Action Comics issue this time out was very preachy. I wish this was surprising to me, but it was a common sort of trap for the Superman comics in the 90s. Don't take this as damning. There were still some of the absolute best comics being published at the time, and I still have very fond memories of them. But more so than any other time that I can really relate to, the Superman comics of the era really sort of existed as a liberal fantasy world. How so? Well, let's think about it. Our hero, who used to be called a Boy Scout, but now knows how the world really works, is a crusading, speaking truth to power reporter at a major newspaper in an East Coast metropolis, literally in this case. His wife is not only a crusading reporter as well, but also a feminist who rebels constantly against her domineering military-industrial complex father. And who is the hero's major foe? An immoral, cruel, calculating businessman who made his billions in the aforementioned military-industrial complex while hiding in plain sight. If the term existed back then, post-crisis Lex Luthor would have been the ultimate one percenter. I mean, it's all right there. Of course, I mean this in jest and good sport. Honest. This Bloodsport was actually the second man to use the title, and as these things tend to go, at one point the two Bloodsports fought each other. And considering the first Bloodsport was African-American, well, there you go. Thanks, Luke. And my theory about Superman as a liberal fantasy has... It just kind of came to me one day, and it all kind of fits, which is... In one sense, a little upsetting, but I can see how that works, you know. Considering when a lot of those tropes about Superman were formed, back in the 30s, for him being a crusading reporter and all that, it really fits, and it didn't have necessarily the same connotations that it might in a modern setting.
Interesting. I was probably trying to avoid the touchy political subtext, so I went with the totally non-controversial religious reading.
You know, and it's true, though, a lot of these Superman comics of that era are fantastic, and having the four books that function right. essentially as a weekly title meant that you could tell really long-form stories and have plots develop over long periods of time, and it was very tightly woven, but you did get this sort of preachiness. I think comics were striving for a little more relevance in the 90s, and issues that were relevant in the 90s, and this sometimes led to this sort of preachiness. You know, I don't know that we needed to be beaten over the head about racial injustice from a guy named Bloodsport, but again, you know, this is one of the functions that comics serves, and that general era of Superman was a lot of fun, a lot of good stories in there, and they were usually pretty good about having coherent storyline to the point that you could understand it, picking up one at random like you do, Professor. But if you manage to get a run,
right.
it gets much nicer.
And I think part of my frustration in that, with that issue in particular, was for the next episode, I finished up the John Sable story, which had aspects of AIDS and HIV and sexual orientation. But that was woven so naturally into the story, in comparison, that Superman story does come across, I think, especially to modern ears, as a first-time reader, as I was, as a very special episode, as bordering on PSA. That was just my take. And then we move into talking about our three-episode extravaganza.
Yeah.
Of the 60 comics everyone should read. And one of the things I really liked about that list and about that episode and about some of the feedback we got, is I liked that list went beyond just comic books, certainly just beyond superheroes. But I like that our old friends Tintin and Asterix were in there, which of course I mispronounced. I think I just mispronounced it there. Asterix. Not asterisk.
Asterisk.
to which Steve Lacy and to a lesser extent Dave Walker totally called me out on. I get, you know, we get no respect, Emily, for being the only American podcasters who have ever heard of Tintin and Asterix. We get shot down for mispronouncing it. But before
I can't see it, but I'm shaking my fist at England.
But before we get too lost in the weeds on that, I did want to do one special shout-out. In the one episode, I think it was the second of the three episodes where Hellboy was mentioned, Emily went on an extended discussion.
It was an edited, extended discussion.
It was the raw recording was longer, about how much she loves creature actor Doug Jones, and I happened to Twitter that out and at reply him, and his response was, "Thank you, Alan, very much. Go give Emily a hug for me."
Oh.
So our assertion that Doug Jones is the nicest, friendliest person in Hollywood was simply confirmed.
I don't fangirl often. I will fangirl about Doug Jones because he is the best human being.
Now, one of the sort of general themes that came up in that series was that a lot of manga were included on that list, which Emily was very excited about. And not surprising, given Luke's interest in Godzilla and evidently other Japanese pop culture, you were able to bring some information to us about the manga side of that list as well.
And what's funny is, like I said, I love tokusatsu, which, for those who may not listen to Earth Destruction Directive, is it's Japanese for special filming and refers to live-action special effects movies and TV shows, like Godzilla, which was the first true tokusatsu, and shows like Ultraman or Kamen Rider, the Super Sentai. So there is some crossover there, but I'm not a huge anime or manga fan. There's only certain things that I like. It confuses the heck out of Netflix when I say, no, I don't like this anime, but I like all these live-action shows. So even though I've read some manga and stuff, I know some guys that are huge anime and manga otaku. So I've learned a lot about it over the years. And one of the things that was interesting, Emily, you were talking about how it seems like, especially in this country, manga seems primarily aimed and marketed at girls and at women. And I agree with this. In this country, a lot of times it is. But what's very interesting is that, like most entertainment in Japan, manga is very classified and organized. If you think that American fanboys are bad about classifying things down to a certain level, the Japanese otaku take it beyond the pale.
Oh yeah, it's nothing in comparison. And
so in Japan, there are four major types of manga. You've got shonen manga, which roughly translates to boys comics; shoujo manga, which roughly translates to girl comics; seinen manga, which is young men's comics; and josei manga, which is young women's. And a lot of the series that we tend to think of as representative of manga here in the States are shoujo books. Sailor Moon, Fruits Basket, Cardcaptor Sakura. The most popular form in Japan is shonen, is the boys manga, which is things like Naruto or One Piece, Dragon Ball, and my personal favorite manga series, which is a book called Slam Dunk by Takehiko Inoue. So in Japan, it's much it is here. It's the market is still dominated by young male readers, much like it is here. For whatever reason, that's not the way it translates when it's brought over here and marketed in a lot of ways. Even books that are primarily aimed at males in Japan, Naruto being the big example that I can think of, tend to sell to women over here. And so I was thinking about that after that episode, and I was thinking, well, part of it, I think, has got to be because of the way that these stories are presented. They're presented normally as an anthology in a larger magazine. So instead of getting 22 pages that we got to tell a whole story in, you might get 8 pages, and the stories tend to go longer and longer than a Western comic, so there's more emphasis placed on the emotional development of the character, the relationships between the characters, and the growth of the characters. And so, I mean, I don't want to make a generalization and say, oh, that's why girls like it, but I think that has to play a role in it.
Definitely, and my dad also mentioned the way that manga is distributed, that it's, for the most part, you either get it through some sort of internet distributor or you get it at a Barnes & Noble, like a more traditional bookseller, because they look more like books. So they will be shelved like normal books, and it doesn't have the same sort of stigma, I think, of having the 22-page, still sort of disposable-ish form of a monthly comic. I always think of shonen and shoujo. I always forget about seinen and josei because, I don't know, they don't get imported as much, I guess, or they're just not as popular. But what I've actually found is that most people, regardless of gender, watch shonen stuff. That in the 90s, shoujo was huge. But I think the way that a lot of people now are getting into anime and thus into manga is through things that were like Adult Swim, Toonami, those sorts of programming blocks. And those tended to focus a lot more on those action, adventure, shonen sorts of stories. So the first anime that I ever got really into, to the point that I decided to go out and start purchasing the manga, was Rurouni Kenshin.
Yes.
Which still technically does count as a shonen series, but does have a lot of female characters and a lot of those deep emotional connections. A lot of time was devoted to relationships, not just of romantic relationships, but friendships and teacher-student relationships, that really was the focus. And then there was also tons of action. Mm-hmm.
And you know, even going back before Cartoon Network, it was traditionally shonen books that were adapted to anime or tokusatsu. Books like Mobile Suit Gundam, Astro Boy, Mazinger Z, and then even stuff that went to tokusatsu, like Kamen Rider, began life as a manga. And then that it became a tokusatsu instead of an anime, it was just a twist of fate that, you know, changed, created an entire a series that's still running to this day of tokusatsu shows. My favorite manga is a book called Slam Dunk. You know, Slam Dunk is a book about basketball. You'd think, oh my God, that's got to be the most straightforward book of all time. It's a book about a guy playing basketball. But again, because of the way that it was originally published as a part of an anthology, the endearing part about Slam Dunk is the character, the main character, whose name is Hanamichi Sakuragi, who's this guy that he's a tough guy, but all through high school, he was rejected by 50 girls in a row.
Oh.
And the last girl who dumped him said, oh, I don't like you because you're not a basketball player. And so in his first day of high school, as he's, you know, sulking and everything, a girl comes up behind him and says, hey, you're tall. Do you play basketball? And he turns around and he's going to headbutt her. And he sees the girl Haruko and falls in love with her immediately.
Of course.
So he bluffs and says, oh, yeah, I'm a basketball genius.
He's never my gosh.
So he goes out for the basketball team. And of course, her older brother is the captain of the team. You know, he's a complete imbecile on the court. So in one sense, you could look and say, oh, it's a comedy book about this guy trying to play basketball. It's like, or maybe it's a sports book about the games themselves. But the strength of it is that Sakuragi, he's a punk. He's never done anything in a devoted way in his life. But now he's doing it, first out of his desire to impress Haruko, but then as he finds that, hey, I really enjoy this, and this is something that's meaningful. So it's his growth as a character that we're reading in the tankobons, the collected volumes, mm-hmm. that it's like, and each one's like, okay, this is a guy that's growing and changing, and he's, you know, he's not just a big goof, and he's not just a comic relief character. There's a lot of heart and a lot of emotion here, and that's what drew me into the story and why I kept reading it. And I've watched most of the anime as well, so now you get to compare and contrast the anime and the manga. I don't know. I can see both sides of it. I understand why a lot of Western comics fans turn their nose up at manga. There was a period in the late 90s where that's all we were told. Is like, well, if you're not like manga, you're not going to sell. If you're not like manga, you're not going to sell. And Joey Mad, God bless him, drew every Marvel book he touched like it was. and that, you know, oh, we have to release everything as a 100-page OGN. The single-issue comics are dead. It's like, well, that's not true because the model still works. So yeah. I can understand why the Western comics fans are annoyed about that, but I can also understand why the manga fans are annoyed at being dismissed as stupid girl crap. When, you know,
yeah.
Because they're reading a tankobon of whatever manga they enjoy. You know, we should get along, but we're not going to because we have to be right because we're fanboys and fangirls, you know.
Yeah. I've heard good things about Slam Dunk. I will admit that I, you know, not to come off as holier than everybody else, like, I am a snob when it comes to my manga, that I am not a fan of sports mangas.
Yeah.
Basically at all, because someone showed me 4 pages of Prince of Tennis, and I was like, done. I'm done with this whole genre. It's not worth it. There was like a tennis ball turned into the meteor, and then dinosaurs were like running, like rising out of a volcano, and I was like, I'm done with this.
This is why some of us have some strong opinions about manga. It's because of things called, what was that? King of Tennis?
Prince of Tennis.
Oh, yeah. Prince of Tennis. That sounds so much better.
Well, to be fair, Slam Dunk is considered to be the greatest sports manga of all time. You know, it's and again, it's
if I'm going to break out for one, it should probably be the best one.
I have my theory that which I call the minimum Batman appreciation index, which states that everybody likes Batman at some minimum level. Nobody actively dislikes Batman. Even if you only like, even like, well, I only like Batman the Animated Series. Like, well, there you go. That's that's the level of Batman appreciation that you're at. I think there may be a similar index for Godzilla. I think base level enjoys watching a guy in a suit smash a model city. They might not admit it, you know, not talk about it at dinner parties, and they might not end up like me being cited in an academic paper as Godzilla expert. That's a true story, by the way.
Well, there you go. Claim to fame.
We had to look up how to cite an interview in the MLA style handbook.
We just picked up a few issues of Lone Wolf and Cub in the quarter bins.
Which I'm going to make Dad read.
So that's going to be an upcoming episode. So I'm actually looking forward to that one very much. That's one that I've certainly heard good things about.
And Lone Wolf and Cub was actually adapted into a series of films back in the 70s, I believe. And they were actually released by Toho, the same studio that owns Godzilla. Great stuff. And it's funny you'd mentioned Lone Wolf and Cub, because one of the other series that was on your list was Usagi Yojimbo.
Yes.
And those two thematically tie very closely together because they're both samurai stories. The difference being that Lone Wolf and Cub takes place in a pseudo-historic environment, and Usagi Yojimbo takes place in a pseudo-historic environment with talking animals. And it's not nearly as silly as it sounds, because, again, much like I mentioned earlier with Uncle Scrooge, just because it's a funny animal story doesn't mean it's just for kids. It's a straight-up samurai story, and it's an all-ages story. It's bloodless, but it's definitely a story about honor and betrayal and revenge. Usagi Yojimbo translates as rabbit bodyguard. Usagi is rabbit, and Yojimbo is was it a common name for a samurai that was a bodyguard. And the main story is that Usagi is a ronin. He's a masterless samurai during feudal Japan, and the various adventures that he gets into and the different plots he's drawn into. And a lot of people know Usagi Yojimbo, especially folks about my age, because he had some appearances with the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles.
Huh.
Which seems like a natural type of thing, you know.
Yeah.
Japanese culture. Usagi actually appeared in the original Turtles toy line, and he appeared in the revival toy line from the early 2000s, and he appeared in both cartoons as well, both times being drawn to the present via some kind of a time warp.
Hmm.
So that's a lot of people know Usagi just from his connection to the Ninja Turtles, but then don't necessarily realize that Stan Sakai, I think, did like 15 or 16 volumes of original Usagi stories. I forget what studio published those. It wasn't I don't think it was Fantagraphics. I think it was before them. But just a lot of fun stuff. Not something you see all that often anymore. But I have a few volumes of that. It's a lot of fun. Sakai's got a very clean style on his art. Very minimalist. So it really looks like some funny animal stuff. But, you know, with sword duels and blood oaths.
Awesome.
Yeah, one of the things sort of thematically or topics we've talked a little bit about on the show, and Emily and I have talked about it a lot in real life as well, is this idea of comic books as a genre, and that when you say comic books, everyone assumes you mean spandex and capes and secret identities and superpowers, strange visitors from another world or something. one of the eye-opening things about this list was that there was so much in the medium of comics that was different from the genre of superheroes. And perhaps part of that was this list sort of catering to people who felt that way. I mean, it may have been a little self-referential or self-reverential, you know, patting themselves on the back. But I think that's an important distinction, that the graphic medium can tell any kind of story. And at manga, that seems to be more accepted, perhaps?
It's more built into the classification, that you're going to get very different kinds of stories that are labeled as shonen and shoujo. But
okay, right.
Even within those, like, technically, Puella Magi, Madoka Magica, and Sailor Moon are the same genre, and they are not. Puella Magi is, everyone always talks about, like, the dark version of the shoujo manga, and it is so not appropriate for kids. It's horrifying. You can break it down from manga, but you're going to run into a lot of the same problems of what should be a shonen, what a shonen series should be.
No, you're right. Get any type of system that is so classified, that's where the arguments break out, you know? And as far as medium versus genre, I sent this in the email in all caps, thank you, Emily, comics are a medium and not a genre. Because it drives me nuts to hear that, because it when somebody says that, they're demonstrating a basic misunderstanding of what a genre is.
Right.
And you know, it's like there's no comics genre. Just like when I was in college, we had to argue that there was no anime genre. I'm on a tokusatsu board that I'm probably the oldest person on by a good 10 years. And people will come on and say, oh, well, is this an animated tokusatsu? And I said, that's a contradiction. It's anime, then. Could it be an animated henshin hero show? Sure, that's possible. That is a genre where the hero transforms into a different form to be the hero. That's fine. Cannot be an animated tokusatsu. That doesn't work. You could say something is an animated comic book if it's something like the DC film of The Dark Knight Returns, which looks a lot like the Dark Knight Returns story and is animated, but it's still not in the comic book genre.
I have many axes to grind, but that is definitely up there. Like, it frustrates me a lot whenever people... I didn't mind at college when people would come up to me and be like, oh, you're like the comics books person. Tell me about all comics. And I'm like, I read 6 DC titles regularly. That's it. Yeah. I have no idea what's going on at Marvel. I have no idea what's going on at IDW. I have no idea what's going on with Image. I have no idea with anything. The reason I started my podcast was to actually learn something about comic books that I'd never read before. Ah, frustration.
And I'm in the same boat a lot of times. At work, I'm the guy who knows about comics. Mm-hmm. And what's is that my wife and I, we used to work at the same for the same company. And it got to the point where I was so well known, they would ask her about comics questions. What's funny was, there was at least one time I remember, it was right when Fantastic Four Rise of the Silver Surfer was coming out, and some of her coworkers asked her about the Silver Surfer, and she had heard me raving enough about the Silver Surfer that she was able to answer their questions.
Awesome. That's,
I was very impressed. I said, good job on that.
Yeah, I was going to say, good for her.
Emily, in that Fantastic Four movie, who played the Silver Surfer?
Best person in the world, Doug Jones.
That
also
is correct.
Best thing in that movie, Doug Jones.
That is...
To beat the Silver Surfer in anything, though, because the Silver Surfer is pretty awesome.
Yes.
And actually, Professor, I was thinking about this today. I was thinking that I know you're a big fan of Doctor Doom, and I'm a big fan of Iron Man. So at some point, we're going to have adventures traveling through time, going back to, you know, Camelot.
Those are awesome stories.
Oh my gosh, yes.
Those are some of the best. I mean, Doom and Iron Man, it is a match made in heaven.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Doom is Iron Man with a little bit of magic.
Yeah.
But, and one of the nice things about the Marvel Universe is that it is one world. You can have Kingpin float back and forth between Spider-Man and Daredevil as a villain. You can have Doctor Doom fight Iron Man. It's possible. You're not limited to, you know, the strange geographic boundaries of the DC universe. yeah. where the Flash is in Central City and Captain Boomerang thus can never evidently leave the city limits. Though yeah. they can't seem to keep him in jail, but he seems to never be able to leave the that's city my, limits of Central City.
That's why his name's Captain Boomerang. You
know? Yeah. Oh! Ah.
I mean, it's one of the most widely circulated Luke Cage panels of all time is from the first year or so of Luke Cage.
Yes.
Very rarely had anything to do with the larger Marvel Universe, which is why he has such a large and often hilarious rogues gallery. But in the first year, he did have a story with Doctor Doom, where basically Luke got involved in this plot by Doom and a bunch of Doom bots in New York, and Dr. Doom, in disguise, hired him, and then stiffed him on the bill.
Oh.
So Luke Cage breaks into the Baxter Building, steals one of Mr. Fantastic's jets, flies to Latveria, busts his way into the Royal Palace, and demands his $200 from Dr. Doom. And the Dr. Doom's line of, when my sentries told me a large black man was causing problems at the border, I knew it must be you. Jeez, ladies and gentlemen. And then, and of course, Cage's response is, where's my money, honey?
Nobody calls Doom honey.
Yeah.
Except Luke Cage, apparently.
Hey, you know what? It's all good. At the end, monsters get fought and beaten. Comic books get read. Heroes win, villains lose, and people in graphic novels get cancer. So everything's right in the world.
Yeah. I mean, yeah. We did notice that thread.
Yeah.
And I've got nothing against autobiographical comics. I love Jim Valentino's autobiographical comics. I love American Splendor. One of my absolute favorite bits ever from any comic is the one-panel American Splendor where Harvey is walking, and I think it's R. Crumb who drew this one, where he's walking and he catches a glimpse of himself in the mirror, and the caption is, oh, there's a reliable disappointment. I mean, I love autobiographical stuff, but it gets so heavy. I mean, the only OGN I've ever read that wasn't super heavy like that was Harvey Pekar's Our Cancer Year, which describes his ordeal with cancer, which was really a typical Pekar, you know, it's all self-deprecating the whole time. Emily, you had mentioned your favorite Far Side comic was the natives hiding all their modern stuff, yelling, anthropologists, anthropologists.
Yes.
My favorite Far Side comic, which I have kept with me at every job I've ever worked. It's got three folks in lab coats with holding clipboards looking up at a rickety-looking rocket. And the caption is, it's time we face reality, my friends. We're not exactly rocket scientists. I put that up on my wall, a cube wall, or board at every job I've ever worked.
And I think that sets an appropriate tone for your colleagues. That's important.
Awesome.
The fact that I work at an engineering firm just, you know, really
Yep, that helps.
Now, Luke, we've talked numerous times about Earth Destruction Directive, and we've hinted at the horror podcast, but give us a brief or not so brief rundown of all the various places we can find you on the interwebs and podcasts, etc.
My main show is Earth Destruction Directive, which is part of the Two True Freaks podcast network at twotruefreaks.com. I try to be monthly, covering all the entire world of Daikaiju or giant monsters, whatever that may be, movies, TV shows, comic books, video games, the whole nine. I also am one of the co-hosts of the Vault of Startling Monster Horror Tales of Terror, which is our horror podcast, also at twotruefreaks.com. Currently, we're doing two different series. We're working through a primer on Italian horror. And our next film coming up for that, as of this recording, should be Lucio Fulci's Zombie, which is a gore classic. And we're also watching the Friday the 13th films. We're up to number 4, I believe, on that series as well. I also run, occasionally, a Hawkman blog. Big fan of the Winged Wonder and the opinion powerhouse that is Hawkgirl as well. So that's at beingcarterhall.blogspot.com. I need to get back into updating that one. I also have a basically abandoned general comic book blog, which is El Jacone's Comic Book Bunker, which is at El Jacone's Bunker. That's LJACONES Bunker.blogspot.com for my ramblings about comics that don't necessarily star Hawkman. And you can find me on Twitter at El Jacone. That's again LJACONE And you can now find Earth Destruction Directive on Facebook. Signore DiMonzo required it as part of our new contracts. And you don't cross the boss, as we say at Two True Freaks. Earth Destruction Directive, and you'll find me. Nobody else has that name because other people use better names than that on Facebook, apparently. But if you want to get in touch with me, you've got options. So.
Well, Luke, thank you so much for joining us. Certainly appreciate you.
I really love all three of the shows you guys do, and I appreciate you guys having me on here to take over your feedback show and talk about myself for 2 hours. So I appreciate that very much.
And we certainly have appreciated your support and your letter writing campaign, and everyone else who gave feedback as well. You could learn a thing or two from Luke, though.
If only by an example of what not to do.
We appreciate all the feedback from all our listeners. And if you write an overwhelming number of emails, maybe you too can be a guest on the next feedback episode.
Thanks for listening to the show. Check out our website at relativelygeekypodcast.blogspot.com or search for us in iTunes. And feel free to leave us a rating or a review. If you have feedback for this show or either of the other Relatively Geeky productions, email us at relativelygeeky@gmail.com.
And in the words of one cool dude, keep 'em stompin'.